He leans in close enough for me to breathe in his familiar scent. Sweat, pine from biking through the woods, and a hint of citrus from his shampoo. His face falls. I know what he's thinking. We don't keep secrets from each other. Moment of appreciation. This is the first time I have ever encountered a YA boy who is described as smelling like sweat. Clearly, this author actually knows what's up. Hey there, people. Welcome back to the Great YA Quest. I'm your host, Renee MPT Cray, and in just a few months, I will be turning the big 3-0. I also have NO patience for anything corny and romantic and hormonally charged, yet I make it a habit to read young adult fiction in the desperate quest to find one that I can genuinely argue to be deserving of a 5-star rating. Just last episode, I actually found one, so there is some light in the dark tunnel of our journey. Speaking of light, our story today centers on a girl whose whole identity is caught up in the premise that she, as a child, burned another child to death. Not exactly the same type of light, but hey, we gotta go with what we got here. Today we'll be talking about Little Creeping Things by Chelsea Ichaso. This book is a brand new release. I'm pretty sure it came out only a month ago, June 2nd, 2020, what at the time of this recording was a month ago. I actually won an advanced reader copy from the author on Instagram, so that is what my review is based on. So with that being said, bear in mind that this is not the final published form, although it's probably pretty much close to the same thing. They don't usually change too much. And I will also add the disclaimer that having won this copy for free does not affect my review whatsoever. I'm far too opinionated and grumpy to be swayed, except maybe sometimes by snacks and wine. Anyways, I entered the giveaway for this book, and I probably would have purchased it even if I hadn't won it because you know where I'm going with this. The cover is really pretty. The title Little Creeping Things is written in an uneven all caps blue font with the message, "I'm so glad we're in this together," in the top right corner. And in the bottom left corner, there is a porcelain doll's face looking upwards with a little tear gathered in the corner of its eye. Other than books, dolls are a little obsession of mine. I collect them, I read and review creepy doll books and movies, Tiffany Valentine is a queen in my world, so yeah. Cover alone, I had to get it. The advertising for this one also really pushed that this story would feature an unreliable narrator. And as you found out last episode, I really enjoy the concept of unreliable narrators since it provides an additional challenge of trying to figure out how much of the story we can trust. The concept of this story is that our main character, Cassidy, has been living with a stigma her entire life. She can usually kind of deal with it, but a problem has arisen. One of her biggest bullies has suddenly gone missing, and although Cassidy believes she has information about it, she doesn't trust herself to go to the cops because A, she's not sure she'll even be believed because of her background, and B, because she hated this girl and had kind of come up with plans on how she could, in a perfect world, get rid of her. So, yeah, stressful time for Cassidy. Based on that premise, I was expecting a kind of creepy thriller type of story where we don't quite know exactly who to trust, including our MC. And of course, I hoped for at least a few appearances of creepy dolls, because one of my ultimate pet peeves is when you put a doll on the cover and then no doll shows up. Like, don't do that. Just if you're going to show a doll, give me a doll in the story. Don't just play around with my emotions like that. Come on, I bought this for the creepy dolls. So that was my other hope. Ready to meet the cast? Well, let's go. So our main character is Cassidy. Now, when she was little, she was involved in a fire. She and her neighbor friend were in Cassidy's treehouse together when a fire somehow broke out. Now, Cassidy is very unclear on this. She only kind of remembers it in snatches. She just knows that she was in the treehouse when this fire broke out. And if her brother, Asher, had not noticed it and pulled Cassidy to safety, she would have died. When Asher went back to try to save the neighbor, well, you know, RIP. Because nobody knows how the fire got started, they assume that Cassidy started it. Cassidy doesn't have many friends, and she has an especially difficult time getting along with women, apparently, as she only hangs out with her big brother, Asher, and her best friend, Gideon, with whom she has, well, an interesting relationship. I get up much too fast and shove my way through the swarm of volleyball players. I spot Gideon at the back of the gymnasium, clothed in football practice gear, and rush toward him. The panic starts to fade with each step closer. Laura scurries ahead of me, flinging her chestnut-colored ponytail and impeding my path. Cass, are you okay? Do you want me to call the nurse? Her sugary voice brings on a wave of nausea. I brush past her, my legs wobbly. Do not lose it. I'm great. Other than the total humiliation thing, in front of the whole team and the boy of my dreams. When I reach Gideon, my voice barely emerges over the lump in my throat. Can we get out of here? He studies me for a moment, his olive skin flushed, dark eyes concerned. Then he nods and slings an arm around me. So these two are best friends, but clearly, Cassidy wants them to be more. Their relationship is a little bit odd to me because, like I said, they're technically best friends, but Cassidy introduces us to him with the quote you just heard, so she is clearly not thinking about him in the sense of brotherly platonic love. Cassidy has a difficult time overall, and I mean, I guess I'm sympathetic to her. It's just, like, listen, I was a teen. I might have been homeschooled and, you know, therefore didn't have the same Carrie White high school experience that apparently all the YA books talk about, but whatever. I was a teen. I know how mean they can be, and I have supplemented that knowledge with far too many YA books. But I'm kind of finding it hard to believe right off the bat that Cassidy was in a treehouse that happened to catch on fire, and there's no evidence that she had anything to do with it, and yet these girls torment her constantly. Okay, so the door happened to be jammed from the inside, and yet that makes them believe that as a child, Cassidy lit the treehouse on fire and then locked both herself and her friend inside. Wouldn't you rather just assume that, you know, kids are stupid and they locked the door to keep Big Brother Buttface or someone else out? These girls torment Cassidy constantly for being a supposed killer. And it's to the point where even Cassidy herself seems to believe that maybe she might have had something to do with it. I want to talk to Gideon, the person who's known me since second grade and never once whispered about my homicidal tendencies in the school halls. The person who's always known just what to say to cheer me up. Homicidal tendencies? Like this one thing happened one time and everyone acts like she's Michael Myers. How stupid is this town? Like, okay, I think we're supposed to be subtly seeing her as an unreliable narrator because of this, but the thing with the unreliable narrator, as we found out last time, is that they should at least be believing that they are telling the truth so that we can start picking apart the bits of their stories on our own. But Cassidy doesn't have any of that. Cassidy straight up believes that she herself could be, or maybe even is, a murderer, even though she hasn't really done anything. She remembers doing nothing. Cassidy is just picked on all the time, and she doesn't have enough of a solid backstory for me to trust the rumors about her. So, I don't know. Like, I feel more pity for her than I feel that she's unreliable. I guess that's where I was with Cassidy at the beginning of this book. Like, I felt really bad for her. Cassidy used to be a star volleyball player, but lately she's begun having these episodes where she will black out and basically just picture fire because of the amount of bullying that she goes through. She's a sympathetic character, and we feel for her. She's trying to be a good person, which already puts her head and shoulders above most other YA heroines. And she just wants to live her life and move on from her tragic past, which is a good goal. And I'm rooting for her. Now, the one person besides her brother that Cassidy can count on is her friend, Gideon. Oh, wait, I think I said that wrong. Her friend, Gideon. That's better. Now, she has a complicated relationship with Gideon, as we specified already, because they are best friends, but Cassidy also makes it pretty clear to us, the audience, from the get-go that she is in love with Gideon. The hideout is mine, the one thing I've kept between my best friend and me. Gideon exhales, his breath warm on my bare skin, and my pulse quickens. A rogue strand of dark hair has fallen over his eyes, and I resist the urge to push it back. When we were kids and built this place, he had the wiry body and static-stricken hair of a primate. Now he's tall, with the muscular body of an athlete. That's not how you describe your best friend, even though you just said he was your best friend. You clearly know. There's too much touchy wanting and too much physical appreciation and just that. Yeah. Cassidy knows what she wants, but is like trying to still see Gideon the way she did when she was a little kid for some reason. And somehow Gideon notices none of this, apparently, because again, in YA books, guys tend to notice nothing. Oh, and for good measure, she calls him Giddy. Okay, I know giving slightly awkward nicknames is a way to establish friendships as kids, right? I mean, I had a brother whose nickname used to be Waji, but I only call him that now when I want to piss him off. And meanwhile, honestly, Cass is going on about Giddy's arms and his toned body, and it's like, oh, Giddy! Nope, Houston, we have all the problems with that one. Don't have a little childhood nickname that's supposed to be all cutesy and whatever, and then go on about his body. Oh my gosh, that's a massive nope. With that put aside, Gideon is a good guy. He is a little bit flat as we get started, but he's not a bad person, and he's certainly not the rugged bad boy of YA, which I appreciate so much, because usually nice guy finishes last. We see nice guy as only like the brother type character, which, I mean, Cass is kind of saying he's like a brother, but you know, clearly we're moving past that with her now. And we never get to see the main love interest be a good guy. In YA, good guys and nice guys always finish last. So it's kind of nice to see that we have finally a normal human boy. Now, the other man in Cassidy's life is her big brother, Asher. Asher is the perfect big brother. Starting from the time when he got the treehouse door open and dragged Cass to safety, and continuing right on to the start of this storyline. He has graduated high school and he still lives at home because he's starting his own business. He and Gideon and Cass tend to hang out and watch like cheesy horror movies in the evenings, and he wants nothing more than to protect Cassidy. Cass had a rough day, Gideon cuts in. What happened? Asher's skin is paler than Gideon's, but their furrowed brows match. My face burns as I draw in a slow breath. Fire stuff. Both boys bristle, and Asher's fingers graze the jagged pink scars on his left hand. He steps closer. Who was it? Laura? Calm down. I'm fine. Asher's shoulders slacken. He steps closer, peering down at me with those crystal blue eyes we share. I know what you need. A movie night. Tonight? I force a smile. That sounds good. As long as it's not Firestarter. Asher comes in and out of the story, but he pretty much remains the same. He's the one real constant in Cass's life, since her feelings for Gideon are so turbulent. Asher has done everything he can to try to make her feel better, even replacing her doll that was burned in the original fire, which, another props for this book, they showed a doll on the cover, and even though it's only a little tiny bit, a doll does make an appearance, so yay! The final characters we can cover pretty quickly, so we'll just go for it. Laura is Cassidy's main bully. She always calls Cass a killer and insists that Cass outright murdered the other little girl in the treehouse, who also happened to be her, Laura's, cousin. So it's personal. And because Laura is popular, I guess that's how she's gotten everyone else to join in on this. Because I guess popular girls get their way. Again, I was homeschooled. I don't know much about high school politics, but that's what I'm taking away from this. There can be pretty much no evidence that anyone was a killer, but if the popular girl says that you are a killer, then you are Cass the killer. Melody is Laura's best friend, and she is the silver medalist in the Torment Cassidy department. She is most known for wearing a silver music note pendant everywhere she goes and for having a distinct laugh that sounds like a kookaburra. That one bird that's really random sounding. Yes, that. Her laugh sounds like that. Brandon is a friend of Asher's who used to date Laura and as such had once upon a time joined in on the Cass-hating club. But since Melody kind of got in the way of him and Laura and helped break them up, he's been being nicer to Cass and hating on Melody, even though Cass doesn't really want to have anything to do with him, which is, again, understandable because he picked on her so much. That's pretty much the main characters that we'll need to know for this. So with that, let's move on to our plot. So we open this story with Cass being in the gym playing volleyball, and she has this total freak-out moment, which is triggered by Laura mocking her as being a killer. In this freak-out, she basically has a vision of the gym being on fire, and she sees everyone around her as having doll faces. And that moment was, I mean, I'm living for this. Great start. But our beautifully creepy scene is disturbed by Gideon arriving to escort Cass out, because of course we can't have nice things in YA world. He gets her home and they go off to their special secret BFFs only hideout. I thought for sure we were in for an afternoon of sword fighting and arguing over who would get to be Aragorn when he simply said, "We're going to build a hobbit house." A hobbit house? It'll be our secret hideout. No one will know about it except us. It was our first secret. So they built this hideout when they were kids after they watched The Lord of the Rings, and this is where they spend most of their time, which, I mean, I don't know if it's cute or kind of oddly disturbing that they are still huddling together in this hole in the ground. I think, honestly, I'm mostly just warm to this idea because I'm a Lord of the Rings nerd and I just love anytime Lord of the Rings is referenced. So yeah, it's probably mostly weird that now as teens they're like knee to knee in this little hole that they've dug in the dirt. But you know, Lord of the Rings. So I get it. Now while they're in this hobbit hole, they hear Melody, whose signature laugh they recognize, in the woods with someone, and they joke that maybe she is with Seth, who is the resident school weirdo and who she was seen with earlier that day. Gideon says that at that very moment, he must leave the hobbit hole and text a teammate to tell the coach that he won't be at practice since he skipped it in order to escort Cass home. And since he gets no signal in the hobbit hole, he needs to walk back towards Cass's house, to send the message. No word on why he didn't do that when he left school or before they walked out back, but teenagers do as teenagers be, which is to say stupid. This leaves Cass alone in the hobbit hole when suddenly she hears Melody scream and then call out for help. Cass doesn't know what to do, but she immediately believes that A, Melody has been killed, and B, she knows who did it. I have to find Gideon. I have to get help. But one thought punches through the others, drowning all reason. I have to get out of here. Because I know the other person up there, the one whose hushed voice drifted over the log and into our sanctuary. He and I planned this murder together. Before she can take the time to enlighten us on what she means by this, Giddy returns and claims that he has heard nothing. Cass is freaking out hardcore and saying Melody's in trouble, and since they can't call 911 since they have no cell phone reception there, they have to go help her. So off they go to this little area where the voice came from, and she spots a bottle behind the log, strewn amidst the pine needles. A glass bottle. Normally this wouldn't seem out of place, except this one is raspberry flavored. More words flash in my head. Load her up on raspberry wine coolers flavored with a little something extra. My stomach turns. He couldn't have actually gone through with it. But there's the bottle, at the exact location I scribbled down. It's all line for line so far, minus the scream. After she gets so hung up on this thing about the bottle, Cass mentions two other things that are important to her at this moment. A notebook of hers that is missing, and the fact that she needs to mention the sawmill to the sheriff if she wants to save Melody, but she can't risk doing that. As they head back to her house, Cass remembers that this important missing notebook might be in her purse, so she checks there. It's not there. It's really missing. She reveals that she believes it was taken by Brandon, who is Melody's best friend Laura's ex-boyfriend, also Asher's friend. Gosh, youth friendships are complicated. Asher isn't home, so they wait to see if maybe he found this notebook, because Cass is just losing her freaking mind over it. But Asher doesn't have it, and he dismisses her pretty quickly when he gets home. So Gideon and Cass bike to Melody's house to check on her, and her younger sister Gracie answers the door and tells them that she's not home. As they're leaving, Cass has another blackout episode, crashes her bike and hits her head, and then as Gideon goes for help, she decides to bike off to the mill. Again, this was the sawmill that she was telling, I guess, us that it's important, but she's not saying why, and she knows it's important, but she can't go to the cops with this information because it'll, like, make her look bad. So she decides to go on her own to look at the sawmill and see if anything is going on. So once Gideon's gone, Cass goes off on her own, and while she doesn't see any people at the mill, she does see Melody's signature silver music necklace. She then finally tries to call the cops, but before she can get through to them, something far more pressing happens. A crack sounds behind me, and I freeze, dropping the phone into the tall grass, the voice on the other end still chattering into the air. I spin around, ready to face Brandon or even the blade-wielding ghost of Tom Garrison himself. Instead, Gideon is standing beside an oak tree, ankle-deep in weeds, betrayal etched on his face. How tragic. Now, you might be wondering why she couldn't just tell Giddy from the beginning what's going on, though for that matter you might be wondering why she couldn't tell us what's going on in the beginning, but whatever. But she is afraid that the stigma of her being the fire girl will destroy their friendship slash hopeful future romanceness. Gideon shakes his head. Cass, what aren't you telling me? His eyes narrow as I clamor for words. I gave someone the perfect plan for murder, and he might be carrying it out, I think. If I say it, I'm involved. The thought shrivels and rots as guilt moves in. I'm already involved. But if I say anything about the plan, if anyone finds out, it's over for me. This town will assume Fire Girl found another victim. I shake my head, feeling the separation between us like a fog, cold and thick. I've spent the past 10 years trying to erase this image. Fire Girl. Trying to convince everyone. Trying to convince myself. I'm not a killer. And the only person who bought into my efforts was Gideon. He's always seen a better version of me. Now, that version is about to shatter into pieces on my kitchen floor. This is the one thing I can't tell him. So, she trusts him as the only one who sees her for who she is. But she doesn't trust him enough to not see her as who the town claims she is. So, going back to the main plot, Gideon shows her that Melody posted about getting a flat tire on her Instagram, and when they go into the sawmill, the necklace is gone. So now Cass thinks that Brandon, who she, again, believes is the one who stole her notebook, and I guess who she believes is the killer at this point, he didn't follow out this perfect plan for murder that she, Cass, had apparently told him about, and that he is just messing with her by making her think that he's following the steps that she had apparently written down in this notebook that she believes he stole. Either way, Gideon is so offended that Cass went to the sawmill without him that he doesn't text Cass and he doesn't want to talk to her for the rest of the evening. I'm supposed to go to that party, Gideon says, running a hand over the back of his neck. I'll text you later, Cass. Then he and his comforting scent walk out the front door. Asher scoots closer. What's up with him? I fight the aching, stinging sensation in my eyes. He's mad at me. For not going to the party? You're injured. No, it's not. It's fine. I'll talk to him in the morning. So much for their fellowship of two, I guess. Next day, Cass confronts Brandon since she believes he's messing with her, and she finds out that he wasn't at the practice that Gideon also skipped, which means he very well could have been out there setting up this elaborate prank. While he's not looking, she goes through his stuff, checking for this all-important notebook, and it turns out he doesn't have it. But at that minute, she and Gideon get called into the principal's office to have a meeting with the sheriff because apparently Melody never came home the night before, and Gracie told the cops that Cass and Gideon stopped by looking for her. As they're in this meeting, Cass gets a random text from an unknown number that includes pictures of this murder plan that she wrote in the missing notebook with the text, "I'm so glad we're in this together." Now, instead of telling the cops about this, Cass shuts off her phone, shows them where she heard this whole thing between Melody and her unknown attacker, and then after that, she and Giddy have an argument in which Giddy taps into his YA boy side. I make it through and sit in the dirt, trying to slow my breathing as Gideon paces back and forth. You were right, he mutters, his voice low. I wasted all that time, and Seth really took her. I told you she was in trouble, I whisper scream. It sounded insane, Cass, he growled. I can't catch my breath. His words knock the wind out of me. Insane. Pyro. Killer. Fire Girl. Those are the names Melody and Laura call me. Never Gideon. Now he sees what they see in me. If Melody's dead, Gideon is always going to blame me. He said, it sounded insane, not you were insane. He's literally never called you any of those names. And now, instead of getting an in-depth look at this notebook situation or the actual fire that Cass is constantly blamed for, Cass tells us about a time that Gideon almost kissed her and then didn't. It's not until the next chapter, during a family dinner, that Cass finally divulges the notebook backstory. She was dragged to a party by Gideon and Asher and ended up talking and drinking with Brandon, who'd just been dumped by Laura because of Melody's meddling, and as such wanted to rant to the one other person who really dislikes Melody. They start by joking around about how much she sucks and then end up writing out a detailed joke plan for how to murder her. I dug inside my purse and pulled out the notebook, flipping the spiral-bound pages to a clean section at the back. Then I started scribbling. No, you're wrong. Get her to the abandoned sawmill. She won't go willingly, so take her somewhere romantic first. Like the creek behind my house. There's never anyone there during school hours. Load her up on raspberry wine coolers flavored with a little something extra. Then get her to the mill and strangle her. Perfect time. Perfect place. Perfect method. Perfect murder. So, there we have it. That's the reason why Cass feels like she can't go to the cops or anything. Because those few lines, combined with her past, is she believes enough to incriminate her. Now, call me crazy, but I don't buy it. Like, so you wrote some lines about how easy it would be to knock off a bully, and you were in a burning building as a kid, and other teens think you were somehow responsible, even though the cops found no evidence of that. And because of that combination of events, you are afraid to go to the police, even though an actual living girl is missing, and you heard her screaming, and genuinely believe that she's in trouble. Okay. All right. Now, we need even more evidence for Cass to recover at this point, apparently, because Cass reveals that Melody has something on her phone that incriminates her, and she would do anything to get it back. And Brandon, in this flashback where they're writing in the notebook, basically vows that he will do something to help her because they both got screwed by Melody. Back in the present time, where Melody is missing, Cass starts believing that maybe Seth, the creepy guy, is responsible because he was seen arguing with Melody the morning of her disappearance. So she decides to do the logical thing and break into his car to look for evidence, which there is none. But she does get another message from the unknown number with the picture from Melody's phone that she said she wanted. There's a photo of me attached to the message. I'm wearing a white t-shirt and spandex shorts, but I'm not in the gym. I'm crouched somewhere I never should have been in the first place. My saucer eyes gape at the camera, and smoke fills the background. I know the photo well, because Melody showed it to me after she took it. Now, once again, she does not show this to the cops because she's afraid she'll be incriminated for the fire she's out when she was a child. Yeah. Speaking of which, after a random conversation she has in class establishing that Brandon had an alibi with one of the girls from her class during the time of the attack, Cass goes back to the memory of 2 weeks ago and tells about how that incriminating photo got taken. She was in an empty classroom and apparently Melody started a fire to mess with her, and instead of putting it out, she let herself stare into the flame because it took her back to the time in the treehouse. Melody stood in a daze, like she couldn't fathom how this had happened. Beside her, fiery tentacles crawled from the box to the bookshelf lining the back wall. They climbed up the spines of the books like a red hot phantom, igniting the wooden frame and reaching the ceiling. But I didn't want to let the fire go. Not yet. First, I wanted to remember. I shut my eyes again. So Cass apparently has this thing where if she's in very close contact with fire, she finds it very attractive, which I guess is some evidence for why she might personally believe that she could have started the fire. And she will kind of go back to this moment in the treehouse and remember little bits and pieces. And then in this particular case, she also kind of imagines how nice it would be if she could just, like, walk out and leave Melody there to burn because she hates Melody. So she's having some very deep and disturbing thoughts. But ultimately, she doesn't. Ultimately, she does end up helping put out the fire, but not before Melody takes that picture. And Melody's like, hey, I've got this on my phone, so now I can prove to anybody who asks that you started the fire. And of course, they're all going to believe it was you because you're the fire girl. So that's the history behind that photo. And now that we understand that, Cass determines that since Brandon has an alibi and didn't take Melody, it must have been creepy guy Seth, which is what Gideon has been saying for a while. She and Gideon and Asher go to look at Seth's car, but they see nothing there, as we said. So she befriends his sister Emily in an attempt to learn more about Seth. As she's doing so, she sees something in Brandon's car that looks like it might be Melody's necklace. So now she thinks maybe it was Brandon. Cass and Gideon disagree with each other about who got to Melody, if it's Seth or if it's Brandon, with Gideon believing it was Seth and Melody saying, no, it was actually Brandon because I saw the necklace. And this leads to basically a huge rupture in their friend, brother, fellow love ship. Cass. He reaches out to touch my arm, but thinks better of it. Instead, he fidgets with the pocket of his jeans. Seth has that necklace. I grit my teeth. I explained to you guys 3 years ago how I felt about Brandon. He's not a killer because he dated Laura Gelman. He's a killer because he killed someone. You've got to give me more than that. I want to tell him. I do. To lay out the reasons Brandon's the guy. But I know Gideon. Once he hears about the fire in the notebook, he'll trust the cops to believe me at my word. And they won't. They'll see that photo, the notebook where I described in detail how to kill Melody, my history. They'll start investigating me, and Brandon will get away with everything. He'll be free to do this to the next girl who crosses his path. Gideon squints at me hard before his shoulders fall. You look really pretty, Cass. And he might as well have said, you're dead on the inside, Cass. He swivels around and heads for the steps. I think maybe I'm just really old and slow moving in my brain hole, but I was pretty confused by the plot at this point because Cass keeps jumping from Brandon did it, to Seth did it, to Brandon did it, to Seth did it, to Brandon did it, to Seth did it, and then, oh my gosh, and what's Gideon? I trust him, but at the same time, I can't trust him, and oh my gosh, what's Gideon gonna think? I'm the fire girl, but I'm not the fire girl, and, like, honestly, I understand how this is showing us how fragile and unstable Cass's mind is, but at this point in the story, I was getting really tired of her flip-flopping so extremely from one candidate to the other. Like, it was becoming less about developing Cass as a character and more about, like, oh my gosh, let's just please get somewhere in this story. I could not keep up with how rapidly everything was changing in here. So, you know, this just kind of continues for a while with Cass going back and forth. So let's do something we haven't done in a while. And let's go for a rapid fire list of events that happen. And before I go with this rapid fire list, I am going to go ahead and call. This is the major spoiler alert area. We're going to go right into the more intense part of the book. So if this is on your TBR list, please stop here and come back at a later time once you've read Little Creeping Things. But if this is not on your TBR list, if you are not a YA reader, then here we go. Full steam ahead. Let's go for it. First major thing. Melody's body is found, so guess what? She is actually dead. Giddy starts hanging out with Melody's sister Gracie, Giddy and Gracie, to comfort her, effectively leaving Cass to A, be heartbroken, and B, continue trying to solve this mystery on her own. At some point, Cass deletes the text message evidence from her phone because she is afraid that it makes her look like she is in cahoots with this crazy person, and this makes Giddy super mad at her since, you know, she's supposed to reveal evidence like that to the cops. That's what you're supposed to do. Cass convinces Gideon to skip Melody's funeral and go help her dig up an area where she was sure she saw Brandon bury Melody's necklace, but she can't find it, though she still thinks it was Brandon and Gideon still thinks it was Seth. Asher reveals that he warned Gideon not to date Cass years back because he didn't want her to lose her best friend and a boyfriend all at once in case it didn't work out. And Cass wants to be mad at him but can't stay mad because Asher cares so much about her. Brandon comes over to see Asher and he has the box that supposedly has Melody's necklace in it, but it is revealed that it's actually a please take me back necklace for Laura because he's trying to win her back and he didn't want Cass to see it because he knew that Cass would judge him for trying to get back together with Laura, who is her bully. Cass is now back on the it wasn't Brandon, so it must be Seth train, so she uses her newfound friendship with his sister Emily to break into his room, and she finds creepy yearbook photos of Melody and Laura with their eyes scratched out, so she takes pictures of them and turns them into the cops, resulting in Seth's arrest when they examine his car, and they find traces of Melody's DNA in his trunk. So now, everything seems to be going well for Cass. Except for, you know, things on the Giddy front. She deleted the evidence off her phone. There's no way that anyone knows of her potential involvement unless Gideon blabs about it, and, you know, we know he won't, so she feels like all is good. She decides to attend a school dance because, you know, she's totally not crazy anymore and is doing super well, and she wants to keep an eye on Gideon just to make sure he doesn't get too close to Gracie and or rat out the fact that Cass knows more about this case than she's letting on. Ha 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 ha. Normal school dance. So she asks out Peter, Gideon's math tutor. Side note, I don't know how old this guy is, but the fact that a teen is going out with a tutor kind of makes me low-key uncomfortable. And this guy has made it clear that he has a massive crush on her. They go to the dance and they have a great, perfect, normal time that doesn't involve any craziness whatsoever. Maybe it's the alcohol, but I've somehow acquired the boldness to direct Peter to a better spot. One with a clear line of sight to Gideon and Gracie, where maybe they'll have a clear line of sight to me, with Peter. It's another slow song. Gideon and Gracie are dancing closely and effortlessly, like they've been dating for months. It pressures me to make the same sort of display, and the punch is rallying me on. My hands begin on Peter's shoulders, and his rest loosely on my back. He's making light conversation, joking about how we should have had the dance outside if we wanted a night sky theme, which would have been ludicrous due to the outdoor temperature. I laugh and slowly inch my fingers behind his neck, drawing myself closer to him in the process. I don't look around for Gideon, but simply will him to see us as I gaze into Peter's eyes. My face hovers inches from his, with a demure look I hope will encourage his fingers to move somewhere a little less safe. Now this, children, is what we call full-on self-destruct mode. Because she's had so much alcohol, side note, how do teens in a public high school dance get that much access to alcohol? Because they talk about drinking a lot in here. Cass ends up running outside and puking her guts out, prompting good guy Giddy to come out and check on her. And then they have the moment. This can work. I know it can. And I spoke to Asher. He pries my hand off and steps back. Cass, it's not about Asher. It's about the fact that I can't even look at you anymore. I see you in the halls and I can't breathe. I see you in English and I can barely find the strength to write my name on the paper. When I look at you, I go back to the day Melody disappeared and I didn't help her. After everything that day, the way you kept things from me, from the cops, what you did to Brandon. I love you, Cass. I always will. You have this power over me. My mind isn't my own. I don't try to contain the tears. My legs feel weak, my head impossibly heavy as Gideon continues. I used to think that one day we would be together, but now I know it was all a fantasy. I'm looking at a total stranger. My vision blurs and I bend over, My heavy head sways in circles as I rest my hands on my knees. Black tears drip onto my dress. It's over. Our moment beneath the lights was just that, a moment, ephemeral and fleeting. Our old times have as much a chance of returning as Melody Davenport herself. I knew turning Seth in wouldn't bring her back, but I thought it would bring back Gideon. He puts his hands on either side of me. Here, let me walk you inside. Don't touch me, I snap. Wouldn't want you to fall under my evil spell again. Cass, you can barely walk. I'll manage. I'm going to have to get used to doing stuff without your help. I pull my head up, swallowing back the nausea, and whip around. I rush toward the side door of the gymnasium, praying I won't pass out before I make it inside to the restroom. So if they weren't over before, they definitely are now. But after all this, Peter is still somehow interested in her for reasons even Cass can't understand. Except that a few weeks later, they have a fight over how she always looks at Gideon, and they break up, but then they get back together. And then Cass's bully Laura approaches her, and this happens. She chews on her bottom lip before letting out a resolute breath. I was with Seth the day of the murder. She meets my doubtful look and continues. I left right after you and Gideon did, when Coach ended practice early. Seth was at his house all day. That's where I met him. That's where we hung out until Emily was due to come home. Then we snuck off to Rosedale together until after dark. Wait, why were you with Seth all afternoon? She shoots me an impatient look. We're together. I shake my head. No, but you're his secret girlfriend? She nods, teeth clamped down on her lip. He could go to jail for the rest of his life, I whisper, peeking over my shoulder. Why didn't you tell the cops? I couldn't. Her eyes dart around the hall. The morning before they brought Seth in for questioning, someone left this for us. She pulls a flowery card halfway from her backpack, allowing me to peek. It was on the hood of my car. The card is from one set of stationery Carver's always has in stock, which means every household in town has a pack. There's a typewritten message in the corner of the card. Keep your mouth shut about Seth, or you're next. The killer left one for Seth, too, threatening to kill me if he said anything about us. I don't know how he knew about our relationship. He keeps leaving me these cards every couple days. So now, wrench in all the plans. Seth apparently didn't do it, and maybe Cass actually was right all along and it's been Brandon this whole time. So she does what she does best. She convinces Gideon to come help her, and she agrees to meet Laura after school and go with her to the cops because Laura believes she's in danger and she doesn't want to go alone, but she also doesn't want to, you know, leave Seth to burn in jail forever. But Laura ends up not showing, and then she doesn't answer any of her calls. Nearly frantic because she believes that Laura is now the latest victim of this killer, Cass calls the cops, and they find Laura at her house. Laura denies knowing anything about what Cass is talking about and claims that Cass is delusional and the cops are mad because they think this is teenage drama and Cass is basically at her wit's end because of this. She becomes just confused by herself just as much as I was, so she decides to just take a breath and chill and accept that, you know, DNA was discovered in Seth's car, so maybe Seth is the one who did it like the cops said he did. The next morning, she accepts a breakfast date from her boyfriend. Remember, it's Peter, not Giddy. And while she's in the car with Peter, shit hits the fan. I fumble through the bottom of my backpack where I stashed my phone. There's a text message from Laura, but I'm distracted by a pop of green among the books and folders. I bend over and pick up the item, a green hoodie, letting it hang from my two fingers. A memory of Gideon tugging at the strings of a green hoodie in Hathaway Hall, his eyes distant and jaw scruffy, floods my mind. I swallow hard. Why do you have this? Peter glances at the hoodie, his knuckles tightening over the steering wheel. Oh, Gideon and I had one of our sessions at good old Gina's a couple weeks ago. He said he hadn't gotten much sleep or something and needed coffee. Peter licks his lips. He practically collapsed onto the desk at the tutoring center. I drove. He must have left his sweatshirt in here. I follow Peter's every movement, every twitch. I'm surprised I never noticed it down there. Peter's voice quavers. He wipes his palms on the steering wheel. I unlock my phone and read the text from Laura, trying to ignore the panicked thoughts swirling in my head. I'm really sorry about yesterday. I started freaking out as soon as I told you about Seth. Then the cops showed me that threat on your phone and I couldn't do it. But I told you the truth. If the killer is sending you threats, be careful. I close the conversation and stash my phone back in my backpack. The once heavenly scent of bread is now suffocating. I want to crack a window or throw the bread outside. I settle for unzipping my jacket. I take a deep breath and try to blink away my dark and blurry vision. I'm going to pass out in Peter's car. After another blink, my eyes open and settle on the brown bag with the blue writing. Gina's Diner. I shut my eyes again. If Peter's a regular at Gina's, he would have seen Melody all the time. She'd been a waitress there since last June, which would have given Peter months to get to know the pretty girl behind the counter. And she must have noticed the gorgeous guy with the emerald eyes who came in twice a week to order a milkshake. Or perhaps to chat up the waitress. Gracie's words simmer in my brain. He was a great guy. Smart. Funny. Was it always Peter? And now, with his breakfast and his jealousy and guilt trips about me looking at another guy, is he grooming me to be his next victim? I'm probably right where he wants me, about to trace Melody's steps out into the woods. I need to find my phone and call Gideon or someone to help. I stuff my hand into my backpack and thrash it around in desperation. As I do, my backpack knocks over a large binder resting at my feet. Something small and silver spills out, joining the pile on the scraggly carpeted floor. A spiral notebook. My body freezes. Peter pulls at my arm, trying to get me to make eye contact, trying to trap me with his sparkling eyes, the eyes of a cat stalking its prey. I gape at him in horror. "Cass," he pleads, "what's wrong? It's Gideon, isn't it? Did he tell you not to hang out with me? That guy doesn't deserve your friendship. Why can't he just let you be happy?" Peter looks at me with his crooked smile, and that smile is no longer adorable. It's sinister. And it was probably the last thing Melody Davenport saw before she died. "Explain this," I snap, lifting the notebook from the pile on the floor. I hold it before him with shaky fingers. Peter's face reddens and his eyes fall. "I was going to return it. I only read a couple pages. I'm sorry." He pushes the hair off his forehead, but it sticks. "I found it a few weeks ago at the diner, and I should have given it back to you right away. But I really liked you, and you didn't know I existed. I thought I could watch some of the movies you wrote about and we'd have something to talk about." His head slumps. "But then I was too embarrassed to return it." "You did something to Gideon," I repeat. I feel around again for my phone, keeping my eyes on him. "That's crazy." "I'm not crazy. Stay back." I flinch. My elbow smacks the glove compartment, sending a bolt of pain up my arm. "Cass, I don't know what you're talking about. Why would I do something to Gideon?" "I don't know. Because he was getting between us? Because he was helping me look into Melody's murder? Because I told him about your threats? Where is Gideon when I need him?" Finally releasing my seatbelt, I search frantically for some way to distract Peter. So Peter has Gideon's hoodie, as well as Cass's notebook, the one with the murder plans in it. So now, surprise, surprise, Peter is the killer. Now, Cass escapes from the car, freaked out, of course, and runs into the woods, the same woods where she was when Melody was killed. She finds Gideon's phone there, cracked, and freaks out because she believes that Peter must have attacked Gideon, and she is next. And that's why he came to get her for this breakfast date and try to get her alone. Peter chases her into the forest, and while they face off, they hear the sound of Gideon's voice from the area that has been the heart of all these issues. The log in the clearing by the beach where Giddy almost kissed Cass but didn't, and, you know, less important in the world, where Melody was taken to be killed. Peter and I sprint towards the sounds, which become fainter with every step through the mossy, leaf-ridden ground. We near the log, where I'm certain Gideon is hurt, or worse. We hear voices, or a voice, as we near the log, And this time, though still obscured beneath the sounds of rushing water, there is no mistaking it. The same voice from the day with Melody, the voice that haunts my dreams. It hits me in the gut, knocking me off balance. No. When we stop, Peter pulls my face before his, mouthing, "What's going on?" "Breathe." I whisper into his ear, "It's Asher, the killer, and he has Gideon." Asher, as in her brother. He has Gideon all beaten up, and he has the doll that he took from Cass's room to repair a little bit ago, but it's broken open now, and she sees that he's taken Melody's missing necklace from the inside of it, where he'd hidden it, along with a scrap of dress that the first girl in the fire was wearing. So he is apparently using it as like this little place where he hides trophies. But all of that aside, Asher, we've gone from Brandon Seth, Brandon Seth, Brandon Seth, Brandon Seth, Brandon Seth, Peter, Asher. So it's Asher now. Now Peter runs off because, you know, he's not Gideon. And Cass is left to reveal herself and plead with Asher for the life of her BFF/Dreamboat. Asher revealed that he swiped Cass's missing notebook, took photos of the pages, realized how mean Melody was being to Cass, so he started to date her and lured her out there to take care of her as a favor to Cass. He also reveals that he's the one who started the fire all those years back because Sarah, the other little girl, the neighbor girl, was threatening to tell their mom that Cass had broken a teacup. So as revenge for this, because Asher wants to protect Cass, he killed this girl and almost killed Cass. Must have been some really special teacups. As Asher is monologuing, Peter sneaks around because he's not so bad after all, and he starts untying Gideon. When Gideon is free, Cass runs away to lead Asher away from them, and he follows her because he doesn't want to face off against two guys and would rather chase down the sister he's done all of this for, so he follows her to the hobbit hole that only she and Gideon know about. He bends down to examine the tarp, but Gideon comes crashing through the wall of trees. He makes his way like a low-riding bullet on the ground, hands outstretched as he shoves my brother forward. Asher yells as he falls into the hole, taking the tarp down into the depths with him. Gideon and I push the woven cover over him just as Peter navigates his way to us. The three of us hold down the cover as my brother continues to stab and slash through the flimsy woven contraption with his tool. We use feet, knees, our entire bodies to keep the cover down. My body trembles with sorrow and fear, making it nearly impossible to keep my grip. My strength is slipping. I can't hold on any longer. I'm about to let go when the merciful sound of sirens resounds through the woods. We shout at the top of our lungs until footsteps reach the outskirts of the barricade. But Asher hasn't given up. He slices straight through the cover and into Gideon's hand, which flies upward as blood spurts over the cover. I want to rush over there, but with him down a hand, my two are even more essential. I grit my teeth and put every last ounce of strength into keeping my brother trapped. A swarm of officers finally makes it through the trees and we back away, allowing them to cuff Asher, whose frantic efforts to escape the hole have ceased. His face resumes the composed demeanor that I know will haunt me the rest of my life. I turn to Gideon in time to see his eyes roll back into his head. Then he collapses as though he'd been holding on just long enough to rescue me. I scream and fling myself over him. I allowed myself to believe Asher's lies my entire life. Now Gideon, who is more family than Asher ever was, is paying for it. I cry in short, staccato bursts, the tears pooling over Gideon's blood-caked body until paramedics tear him away. All right. Just like that, everything is solved. Asher goes to jail. The truth about Melody and Sarah and Cass is revealed. Cass is able to finally look back on her actions throughout the entire ordeal, and she processes them with, surprisingly, quite a bit of maturity. The truth is, I do share something with Asher besides our crystal eyes. There is something broken in me, just like there's something broken in Asher, that lets people get hurt while I walk away unscathed. I know now that much of my identity stems from a lie. I'm not a killer. I didn't even accidentally kill Sarah Leeds. But I let myself believe the lie, the story Asher told me about myself, and it shaped every decision I made. I let those little creeping things embed themselves inside my brain, inside my very core, until they ate away at who I was. They created the hollow person who refused to help Melody, the girl who allowed Gideon's conscience to rot away so I could stay safe, the girl who let the murderer escape so no one would think I'd killed again, the girl who made Seth into Maribel High's new target and later put him in jail. All right, so what's the next step from here? Well, apparently it's Cass and Gideon going to the Hobbit Hole and destroying it together so that they can move forward away from their childhood into their great future, which is cemented by sharing their first kiss. Guys, this book aged me like 10 years, or maybe I'm just aged 10 years too many already. Even after having read this book and then going over it again for this script, it got me confused so many times. Is it Brandon? Is it Seth? Is it Brandon and Seth? No, wait, is it Peter? No, is it... I don't mind having a lot of suspects. And honestly, I will say that was a point in this book's favor because even 3/4 of the way through this book, I didn't know for sure who had done it. I'd actually narrowed it down to either Asher or Gideon just because they were presented as being so perfect and both of them want to protect Cass, and we also didn't know where either one of them was during the murder. So I knew it was going to be either one of them. Then there was a short while where I even hoped that, like, maybe Cass herself actually had something to do with it and she was just blocking out the memory because, like, that would have been really, really cool. Like, that would have been a genuinely unreliable narrator. Because she keeps looking at herself as this horrible human, even though we have seen no evidence of it. Like, okay, so the fire happened, but you were a kid. And yet she still believes that she's this horrible, horrible person. So I was thinking that, like, maybe she was keeping something from us, and we would find out later. But no. Despite being painted as this unreliable narrator, Cass is actually telling it exactly how she sees it. The thing that really had me confused was not that we flip-flopped between a couple of different candidates. It was the way that Cass went so quickly and so extremely from one candidate to the next at the drop of a hat. Like, the instant she hears Melody scream, she knows right away, like, I know who did it, with so much conviction. And then she flip-flops from there on out, back and forth, back and forth, and it can only be one of these two guys. Like, there's no one else on the planet it could possibly be. She never even questioned once, like, could it be Laura, Melody's friend? Could it have been her herself? Could it have been Gideon? Could it have been Asher? She doesn't question any of that. No, it's Brandon or Seth, or Brandon or Seth. And the confusing thing is that she switches so quickly between believing it's Brandon or Seth. Or Brandon, or Seth. Honestly, if she had some sort of solid memory of maybe having something to do with the fire back in her childhood, or if she'd actually, like, set more fires once this had started, then I would have believed why she didn't go to the cops. But you were in a fire as a kid. Teens make fun of you. Teens will make fun of you if your hair is brown or blonde or black. Teens will make fun of you if you are tall. Teens will make fun of you if you are short. Teens will make fun of you if you are a teen or if you are an elderly or if you are a child. Teens make fun. That is what they do. But because teens make fun, you believe that you're going to be, what, locked away if you go to the cops? It just was too much altogether that she believes 100% that she knows it's one or the other of these two guys. She not only can't make up her mind about which one it is, but she also can't even go to the cops because she's Fire Girl. I just, bottom line is, I don't get Cass. I don't get why she is so convinced that she is this bad guy to the point that she would let another human be killed and withhold evidence. The point she makes at the end about how she let the little creeping things get into her mind and torture her, that is a really, really good observation. And I really, really loved that because that is very true, not just for teens, but for all of us, that we will get this idea of someone else's perception of us in our minds, and we can let that shape our whole everything about us. And that's an incredibly dangerous thing. But I wish there would have been a better setup in the beginning of this novel so that I could have really believed those little creeping things along with Cass, and then at the end of the reveal been like, oh my gosh, like, that's true, because I also doubted Cass when I didn't really have that much of a reason to. But instead, the whole time I'm going through this thinking, I don't have a reason. I don't have a reason for anything. So I don't believe ever that she was this fire girl that she keeps, that the whole basis of her character is built up on. Instead, I just saw her madly flip-flopping from one conviction to the next, and I honestly got exhausted trying to keep up and emotionally invest in her beliefs when it's never a thought or a maybe. It's always, this is the truth! I don't care what anyone says! Ah, I am Fire Girl! I want to side with Cass. She is, like I said, a very sympathetic character. There's a lot about her that I really like. I genuinely believe that she wants to do what's right. But honestly, I'm kind of with Gideon here, and I want to take a step back and be like, all right, you do you, girlfriend, because I don't know. That's why I'm saying I think I'm a little bit too old for this book. I mean, I'm too old for all YA, but especially for this one, because I am just mentally exhausted after reading this, trying to keep up between who did what or might have killed so-and-so, and not to mention, OMG, does Gideon love me yet? I think I just literally burned calories. I went back and forth for a bit on how to rate this one because it's honestly not a bad murder mystery overall. Like I said, there are a lot of people who could have killed Melody, who had motivation. And I do like the theme note at the end about how we can't get into our own heads so much that we become blind to what's going on right in front of us. We can't allow what others say about us to define us. That is an excellent moral to have, especially in a book aimed at teens who are so defined by the opinions of the cool kids. Or whoever's opinion you guys are interested in now. Beyonce? Internet trolls? I don't know. I'm out of the loop. I just wish I could have connected with Cass more so that I wouldn't have been constantly exhausted by her every declaration. Ultimately, I don't buy that someone would withhold evidence from a murder just because they were bullied for something that happened to them when they were a little kid that there's no evidence for. And maybe that's because I'm elderly AF, but there you have it. I would say this book has a great moral and it has a solid murder tale, but I personally needed more reason why I should believe that Cass shouldn't go to the cops. Something that doesn't have to do with rumors started by teens and a few sentences written in a notebook. So I will give this one a 3.5 out of 5 stars. When I first read it, I was kind of like, should I go towards more of the 4? Because I do really like that moral at the ending, but again, it wasn't enough to make up for how confused I was throughout the whole thing with Cass just going like, this is it, no, this is it, no, this is it. It was very exhausting for me. So because of that, we will go with 3.5. It is a solid book, but it's not going to be one of my favorite 5-star YAs. Thanks for tuning into this breakdown of Little Creeping Things by Chelsea Ichaso. This one came out only recently, so it's quite possible that you have seen it or will see it on a bookshelf near you. And if you end up picking it up, let me know your thoughts on it. Did Cass move too quickly for you, or do you think it was paced just right? Am I just too old for these teenage-driven issues? Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Instagram at Renee MPT Cray. And keep an eye out for my stories to see hints of what I'm going to be reading for upcoming episodes. I really wanted to have another quote to give you to kind of tease what our next episode will be. But honestly, I'm kind of in between a couple of YA books right now, so I'm not entirely sure what we're going to be reading next month. So it's going to be a surprise for all of us. Once again, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you all next month when we continue on the Great YA Quest.